Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Emergency Club webinar. I am delighted to welcome our speaker for today, European and ORZVS specialist in small animal internal medicine, Sarah Spencer. Thank you, Sarah. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for joining me today. So I'm going to talk about life-saving, hopefully, in leptospirosis. So looking at what we're going to cover today, firstly, I'll introduce the pathogen and a little bit about epidemiology before moving on to how a dog with acute leptospirosis may present, in particular, what body systems we may see affected. I want to tell you about how to maximise the chance of a diagnosis. So that's looking at clinico-pathological changes and also specific disease testing. And then we're going to move on to the suitable treatment for lepto with a focus on acute kidney injury or AKI. Along the way, we're going to look at a few example case studies. So we're going to focus on three cases of lepto that I've seen myself. And there are a couple of questions thrown in to get you thinking as well. So firstly, we'll have a quick look at the pathogen and the epidemiology of the disease. So first question that we've got today, which of the following is true regarding a leptospirosis infection? A, lepto survives poorly in the environment and is therefore more of a problem in hot weather. B, vaccinated dogs are protected from infection. C, dogs are the reservoir host for humans. And D, males and young dogs are at increased risk of contracting lepto. So I'll give you a couple of seconds to make your pick. And then the answer is actually D. So males and young dogs are at an increased risk of contracting the disease. So A is not correct because lepto can survive very well in the environment, and it's actually more of a problem when there's been wet weather. Vaccinated dogs are not fully protected from infection, as you probably know. So no vaccine is 100%, but also we've got the problem with kind of different serovars in the environment versus different serovars that we vaccinate against. And dogs aren't the reservoir host for humans, and we'll come on to that next. So the pathogen is the Leptospira spirochete. So it's a gram-negative bacteria. It's highly motile, and it's quite a strange-looking thing, as you can see in the picture here, a coiled bacteria with a distinct hook. And it is able to survive for many months, particularly in moist soil and water. So the reservoir hosts that we consider are mainly kind of rodents, but also we can see it being a reservoir in our cattle and sheep and also humans. And the reservoir hosts are often asymptomatic, whereas dogs we consider to be incidental hosts, and therefore that's why they can develop quite severe acute disease. When we look at risk factor, I've mentioned the season, but also dogs that kind of have an outdoor lifestyle, so those that are swimming and those that live in kennels or shelters. We mentioned that males are at an increased risk. Any dog that's kind of sporting or farming, hunting wildlife. We also consider young dogs, so those less than 6 months old, to be at an increased risk of infection and certainly a symptomatic infection. And when we look at breed predispositions, some studies have identified that mixed breeds and hounds are at an increased risk. And also, perhaps surprisingly, that Yorkshire Terriers and dogs under 6.8 kilos are at increased risk. But I just want you to remember that obviously lepto is a possible diagnosis regardless of the segment and the lifestyle of the patient. So I've seen it in a kind of middle-aged Yorkshire Terrier before, for example, that never left the owner's garden. In terms of which serovars we commonly see in the UK, this is quite challenging to study, and there is a bit of a lack of evidence at the moment, particularly by the time that the papers are published, the data is quite historical, but I've listed the serogroups that we see in the UK most commonly. And a serogroup is a group of antigenetically closely related serovars. So within the sera groups, you have your sera vars. So those are those listed here. So the ones you're probably most familiar with are ictohemorrhagiae and potentially canicola, but that one's actually rare now due to vaccination. So moving on to the presenting signs and clinical findings, what might we see with this disease? So next question is, which body systems can be affected by lepto? Hopefully this one's fairly easy. So we've got A, eye, B, the kidney, C, liver, D, skin, or E, all of the above. Okay, so the answer is E, all of the above, and I was always told if there's ever an MCQ question that has all of the above in it, it's probably that. So remember that lepto is a multisystemic disease. So when we look at our body systems, we most associate it with obviously the kidney and also the liver, but also it's common to see pulmonary involvement. Because it's a systemic infection, it can affect the endothelial cells and therefore the vasculature. We commonly see changes in the eye. It can affect muscles, both skeletal and cardiac. It has various effects on the hematopoietic system. And then you name it, we can see lepto affecting it. So we've got the meninges, the spleen, pancreas, genital tract, etc. So what does this mean we actually see clinically? Well, acute injury, kidney injury is our typical problem that we see with leptospirosis. And remember, this is a problem that we see damaging the tubules in the kidneys rather than the glomerulus. We also associate lepto with hepatic injury. This more typically is an acute injury, but we're increasingly recognize chronic hepatic injury as well. We might see fever, so pyrexia. We might see bleeding problems. We can see respiratory problems. And in particular, we'll talk about the leptospiral pulmonary hemorrhagic syndrome, LPHS. Uveitis can be seen with leptospirosis, and this can be quite delayed, so weeks to months after infection. We might see vasculitis and other skin lesions. We might see signs associated with myositis and meningitis. And also we can see cardiac arrhythmias due to myocarditis if there's heart involvement. So the incubation period is quoted to be around about 7 days, and that's based on experimental evidence. But we're looking at a number of days. And presentation is often going to include your non-specific signs like lethargy and appetence, and potentially vomiting as well. In a study of 300 dogs with acute leptospirosis, nearly all of them had some kind of renal involvement. So this was ranging from anything from a severe AKI to just maybe reduced urine concentrating ability. Around about one third had some kind of hepatic involvement. Interestingly, and maybe surprisingly, over two thirds of cases had some kind of pulmonary involvement. And we'll talk about this in a bit more detail. But all these dogs were screened quite extensively. So it may be that we don't pick up signs in the pulmonary system in our clinical cases. And then around about a fifth of cases had signs of DIC, so disseminated intravascular coagulation. So we'll look a little bit more at acute injury, kidney injury, and how that might present. So AKI is when you have a failure of the kidneys, obviously, to maintain the fluid, electrolyte and acid base status of the body. So you're likely to see polyuria, polydipsia, azotemia, and interestingly, this might not be present in AKI. Hypokalemia or hyperkalemia, so changes in the potassium balance. Around about 30% of cases of AKI of any cause are oliguric or anuric, so reduced or absent urine production. And then we might see protein in the urine and glucose in the urine, again, as a result of kind of tubular and or glomerular damage there. So my main differentials for an AKI in a dog that might be presenting with lepto would obviously be pre-renal causes, so dehydration, hypovolemia. Although azotemia in these kind of dogs tends to be fairly mild, in my experience, not really exceeding past kind of the late 200s. Toxicity, definitely, so things like non-steroidals, aminoglycosides, potentially pyelonephritis. Obviously, Alabama rot, so cutaneous and renal glomerular vasculopathy, that's gained a lot of recent interest, and that can present with an AKI. And don't forget your post-renal causes. So most commonly in endoxis would be a urolith, specifically a stone, stuck in the urethra. Okay, so moving on to how we might grade these kidney injuries. And I'd really kind of recommend the IRIS website if it's not something you're familiar with to go and have a look there. So not only is there a lot of information about chronic kidney disease, but they've also got information on AKI. And in particular, they have a grading system for AKI, which really shows you the spectrum of disease that we can see. So interestingly, grade one AKI, if you have a look at the description, this might include animals that are actually non-azotemic. So we might recognize cases, for example, that have reduced urine output, or you're seeing a progressive increase in creatinine, but it's still falling within the reference range. So your grades are kind of 1 to 5 in severity. And then it's also recommended to subgrade your cases depending on whether they're oliguric or anuric, and whether they're requiring renal replacement therapy, so dialysis. When we see kind of AKIs, typically there's a kind of phases that the animal will go through. So there's initial phase where the GFR, the glomerular filtration rate, will decrease, and then there's an extension phase before entering a maintenance phase where the GFR is kind of stabilized or plateaued. Before then, hopefully the animal will go into a recovery phase, and the GFR will start to recover. And then it remains to be seen if there's an element of kind of chronic kidney disease in the dog. So most cases of AKI in dogs will typically present kind of in the early maintenance phase. It's really important to promptly and early recognize AKIs, and that's why the iris grading is a really good thing to do in all the cases where you suspect it, because it includes that progression element. And obviously we want to try and identify an etiology where we can, particularly because a treatable cause is potentially going to have a better prognosis. And thankfully, leptospirosis is one of those potentially treatable AKIs. It's not always easy to discern between acute and chronic a kidney injury, even though it should be black and white, it's not. And this is obviously going to have important prognostic implications for the patient as well. So clues to look at would be things like body condition score, has the animal lost weight recently, really quizzing the owners about whether or not they've seen any kind of increase in drinking or urinating. And I always ask, has there been any accidents in the house, for example, that might indicate that the dog is poly uric. So moving on to acute hepatic injury that we might see with leptospirosis, obviously this might manifest itself as a mild to severe increase in the liver enzymes. In particular, I pay attention to the ALP and ALT, but also the AST and GGT. So bilirubinemia may be present, and this is probably about the case in 75% cases of lepto. And then we've got the cases of fulminant hepatic failure, which I've seen a few, and I don't think I'll ever forget them because they're really horribly sick animals. So we might be seeing coagulopathies, hypoglycemia, and hepatic encephalopathy. So the main differentials I would consider for an acute hepatic injury would be toxic in origin. So in particular xylitol, because that can cause a hypoglycemia, rodenticide also, paracetamol. A cholangiohepatitis would be a strong differential, especially in an animal with systemic unwellness if they had a pyrexia, leukocytosis, etc. Definitely want to consider our extrahepatic biliary problems or obstructions, so things like pancreatitis, mucoceles, and then finally neoplasia could present like this as well. So what about respiratory signs? So dogs with leptospirosis may have tachypnea, dyspnea, they might be hypoxic, or we might see milder changes like a rhinitis, a tonsillitis. And these signs may be attributable due to pulmonary edema that can occur secondary to vasculitis, or the dog may have aspirated because of vomiting and regurgitation because of the disease. It might be as simple as the dog's tachypneic because of pain or acidosis associated with their AKI. And then we've got this LPS syndrome, LPHS syndrome. So this has been identified in dogs, particularly in Germany and Switzerland, but also in the US as well. And I can't find any reports of it in the UK, but maybe we're just not really recognising it. So it occurs, tends to be in dogs that are younger, and it might also occur in the absence of respiratory distress, which is why it might go undetected and underdiagnosed. Unfortunately, though, it is often associated with up to 70% mortality, and that's because there's a rapid progression in the respiratory failure, and the dog might die, for example, due to hemoptysis. I think the main differentials that I'd consider in a dog presenting like this would be obviously lung worm, so angiostrongylus, also ARDS, so acute respiratory distress syndrome, which can have many etiologies, and finally a coagulopathy that's leading to pulmonary hemorrhage. Bleeding disorders are not uncommon in leptospirosis, so obviously they might present in different ways as listed here. And then also we can see numerous ocular signs, so it might be things like scleral congestion or hemorrhage, conjunctivitis, as well as more severe changes like panuveitis and hyphema. Other clinical signs are very kind of widespread, so you might have abdominal pain because of the kidneys or liver, but also the dog might have enteritis and pancreatitis associated with lepto. You might see splenomegaly and lymphadenopathy because of the infection. The GI motility might be affected, and there are cases even reported to have an intussusception secondary to lepto. We might see neurological signs, muscle signs, cardiac signs, as we discussed above. And then don't forget to kind of consider lepto when there are some strange skin lesions. So these tend to affect kind of the muzzle or the ear or the extremities. So it's something to think about and potentially biopsy in those cases. So now we'll move on to some real life cases that I've seen, the first of which is Boris. He's an 8-year-old malnutrition Labrador, and he presented as an urgent appointment due to vomiting and appetence, lethargy and discoloured urine over the past couple of days. On your exam, he was very flat. He had about a 7% dehydration based on poor pulse quality, tacky mucous membranes, and you noticed petechial hemorrhages on his gums. He also had mild abdominal pain and tachycardia. So just to think about in this case, what would you advise his owners? In particular, would you be thinking about managing him as an inpatient or an outpatient? Is there anything in particular that you tell the owner that you were worried about? The second example is Mabel. She's a 14-week-old female entire Weimaraner. And she presented urgently as well, and she presented due to extreme lethargy, anorexia, and a really marked polydipsia. She'd had her first vaccination 2 weeks prior, and on your exam she was pretty much collapsed, hypersalivating, also dehydrated, slightly reduced body condition, and tachycardic. So things to think about for her would be, what other conditions would you particularly be concerned about in a puppy this young that's presenting this way? And are there any emergency investigations and treatments you would instigate? Our third example, as a typo it says two in the slide, is Reggie. So he's a 3-year-old male entire staffy who's a little bit different. He was handed to you as an inpatient when you came on to shift. And he presented due to vomiting earlier in the day. He was fairly bright, but your colleague noticed that he was jaundiced and pyrexic. So they performed a basic database already, and it showed a severe increase in his liver enzymes, as listed here, and obviously a hyperbilirubinemia as well. So he's already been started on meropitant and amoxicillin clavulanate and fluids as well. And the owner has limited funds, so things to think about in his case would be what investigations you'd particularly want to prioritise. And we'll come back to the cases a bit later. So diagnostic investigations, what might we do, what might we see? So after you performed your major body assessment, I always want to do my basic database, and I don't know about you, but I feel so much happier when I've got all this information ready in front of me to tackle the case. So this would be things like your PCV, total solids, blood smear, blood glucose, blood gas analysis or lactate if you have that available, electrolytes, urea, maybe creatinine if you have that in-house. Urinalysis is also kind of underutilized, I think, so getting a USG and a dipstick. And then obviously, potentially at a slightly later time, you're going to want to do your serum biochemistry, hematology, and also consider doing a fast T-fast, so your focused point of care ultrasound scan of the abdomen and thorax. Most of you are probably very familiar with this, but the main aims of these scans are to look for free fluid in these body cavities. So baseline parameters particularly important in leptospirosis would be your PCV and solids. So is the patient anemic, or particularly if you're going to be taking repeated samples or worried about hemorrhage or hemolysis, is there an anemia developing? Total solids, I think, are underutilized, so really nice to help guide your kind of fluid control or fluid balance in your animal, and also might give you clues as to whether or not the animal's developing hypoalbuminemia, for example. Lactate and pH is a sign of potential hypoperfusion, etc. And getting a baseline urea and creatinine is particularly important, obviously, if we're worried about AKI. Electrolytes, so you're obviously going to want to monitor trends in these. So potassium in particular, because that can be affected by your fluids, so you might get a dilution effect there. Particularly, you might be expecting renal or GI losses. But obviously, we've also got the potential for a hyperkalemia due to the AKI. Calcium might be affected, so your ionized calcium might be low with AKI. That's the case in about 10 to 15% of cases. And then finally, phosphate might be high. A nice thing, again, to track in AKIs along with your acetemia. It's also really nice to get a baseline SpO2, or if you don't, if you have an arterial blood gas analysis capability, then it's good to get a PaO2 if you can. Again, to be assessing trends, always try and get a blood pressure. We'll talk about a bit later hypertension as part of AKI, but also you might be worried about hypotension because of hypovolemia. Body weight, we obviously weigh every animal, but in particular, this is nice to be tracking over time, particularly when you can't measure urine output accurately. So in the cases where you might not be able to place a urinary catheter, it's really, really nice to be tracking body weight, and obviously to document your effect of any nutrition as well. So what might we see with our hematology in lepto? So we might see a neutrophilia, of course, that might include kind of left shift or toxic change. We might see a leukopenia, conversely, if the bone marrow is affected or there's an overwhelming infection. There are commonly changes in the platelet count, so there might be a mild to severe thrombocytopenia. This is a really nice thing to look at, I think, in cases of suspected lepto. And platelet count may be affected due to consumption, because of bleeding, due to destruction by the immune system, or sequestration in the spleen. And then you might see anemia. It tends to be regenerative or pre-regenerative because of hemolysis or hemorrhage. So the main differentials for thrombocytopenia and anemia, I think, to consider in dogs presenting with lepto would be immune-mediated thrombocytopenia or immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. And obviously then you'd be using kind of other clues to help you make those diagnoses or not. So serum biochemistry, obviously we mentioned azotemia, but you can have AKI without azotemia. Increased liver enzymes, bile acids, bilirubin. It's quite common to see a hypoalbuminemia with lepto as part of the acute phase response, or maybe due to hemorrhage. If there's fulminant liver dysfunction, we might see decreased urea. You might see low cholesterol, hypoglycemia, as we said. Electrolyte abnormalities, as discussed. And then finally, you might see non-specific changes in your CK, amylase, etc. Other blood tests we might want to consider in these leptospirosis cases would maybe be your clotting profile. So many people have this in house now, but if not, then take a sodium citrate tube to send externally. So increased APTT and PT are found in about 15% of cases of leptospirosis. And there may also be other increases in fibrinogen or D-dimers. And then it's also possible to see hypercoagulable states in leptospirosis, and this is probably due to inflammation and liver dysfunction. You might be looking to measure troponin I if you've got suspected myocardial damage, more of something to track over time. Similarly with C-reactive protein as a non-specific marker of inflammation, something good to track. And then finally, if you've got a bleeding patient, angiotensin test or a fecal smear or even kind of Behmen's might be something you could consider. What about urinalysis in leptospirosis? Well, we expect to see an isocyanuria or a hyposyanuria, and this is because of the tubular dysfunction we see. So it's thought that lepto is basically presenting a secondary nephrogenic diabetes insipidus. We mentioned that you can see a glucosuria because of tubular damage, and differentials I've included on the slide at the top for a glucosuria with normal blood glucose might include certain jerky treats. It's been reported with acquired or inherited Fanconi's syndrome and potentially other tubular insults and toxins as well. So proteinuria is, again, something we might see, and usually the urine protein creatinine ratio is less than 2, so not in that kind of extremely severe glomerular damage range. And then finally, it's nice to look for granular casts if you're concerned about tubular damage as well. Remember to try and take a urine sample before starting antibiotics and fluids if you can. I know this isn't always practical, but we'll move on to talking about this when we do our diagnostic test. But it's really easy just to do a quick, for example, cystocentesis in most patients anyway. So imaging that we might want to consider in lepto and what we might find. So I mentioned doing a fast scan of the abdomen to look for free fluid. It's also really useful to have a quick look at bladder size at baseline, and that will help you understand about urine output potentially. So the picture on the left is showing free fluid within the peritoneal cavity, a lot of fluid there by the kidney. And then the one on the right is showing perinephric fluid. So you can see how it's kind of following around the shape of the kidney. So what findings aren't typical of AKI on ultrasound? So could we see perinephric fluid? Might we see small irregular kidneys, hyperechoic cortices, or normal kidneys? So make a pick which you think we won't see with AKI. So the answer is small irregular kidneys. So this is more indicative of chronic kidney disease. But common changes that we might see in AKI include enlarged kidneys, fluid around the kidneys. We might see the medullary rim sign where we have a band of bright echogenicity. We might see a pilectasia, so dilation of the renal pelvis. We could generally see bright cortical changes. But also we can see normal kidneys, in particular if we're not used to scanning the kidneys or we don't have a good machine, maybe there won't be any changes there. And importantly, all these changes are non-specific, so they don't tell you the dog's got lepto. And in particular, things like pyelectasia, for example, you can see if the dog's just PPD or in fluids. Is it useful to X-ray the abdomen? Probably not in general in cases of lepto. Maybe if you can't appreciate renal size on palpation, or if you're considering urolithes as a differential for your AKI, or if you're worried about the dog obviously presenting as an acute abdomen. In terms of imaging the thorax, as we've alluded to, you can get changes within the lungs. So it might be recommended to just do screening radiographs in all suspected cases. So then if the animal does then develop respiratory signs, at least you've got a baseline to go on. And we do expect the changes in the chest to be kind of diffuse or generalized, so non-loba, affecting both sides. But we do tend to see changes mostly in the chordal dorsal region. And these changes tend to be mild interstitial pattern. You might see focal alveolar or nodular changes as well. Pleural effusion is also reported. And there's a paper that discusses the CT changes in leptospirosis as well. So you can see the image on the right is showing that you've got kind of peribroncho thickening. You might also see lung consolidation and nodular lesions. Here are two x-rays, two different diseases, but showing kind of both of these things you might see with lepto. So the one on the left, you can appreciate a caudal dorsal interstitial pattern in a case of lepto. And then the one on the right is a kind of quite a severe interstitial to alveolar, even to nodular pattern. And it's actually a case of angiostrongylus, but severe lepto might look like this as well. So what do we find in our example cases? Well, Boris, he was slightly anemic and his solids were pretty, you know, low end, given that he was dehydrated. The urea and the creatinine were increased. The urea more so than the creatinine, probably because of GI bleeding or more of a pre-renal cause in his case. He had a slight kind of borderline increase in his lactate, slightly low potassium. And he had a thrombocytopenia on his hematology. So immediately, obviously, we did a blood smear and this confirmed thrombocytopenia. He had two platelets per high power field, equating to around about 15 to 20 times 10 to the 9 in terms of our count. So definitely in keeping with spontaneous bleeding that we could see with his petechial hemorrhages. We also found that he had a mild increase in liver enzymes. He had isocyanuria with blood and protein in his urine. His coags were normal. His fast scans were also unremarkable, but we did see that he had enlarged and hyperechoic kidneys. Also, he had evidence of quite nasty enteritis on ultrasound. We did do x-rays with him, and we found a moderate interstitial caudal dorsal pattern on x-rays. And I think the reason why we did a bit more with him was because of the concern over bleeding. And because of that, we also did angio detect and a fecal smear, which were negative. What about Mabel? So she also was slightly anemic, but actually because of her age, this was normal for me. She did have a metabolic acidosis with a base excess of -8. And this is probably due to her azotemia. So you can see here her creatinine is a worrying 340. So blood glucose was something I was alluding to earlier that was very important to check in, obviously a collapsed puppy, and that was normal. Her phosphorus was increased in keeping with the azotemia, but also probably slightly due to her age. And then she also had a hyperkalemia, so our reference range goes up to 4, and hers was 5.6. So her AKI was graded as a three, which is moderately severe. And like I said, with a mild hyperkalemia as well. She also had a mild increase in her liver enzymes. And although she wasn't overtly jaundiced, she had a hyperbilirubinemia. Interestingly with her, the urinalysis showed that she had glucosuria. She also had a protein positive dipstick. So we followed that up with a UPC, which was 0.8. And she was hypocyanuric in keeping with her PUPD at 10.08. And AFAS with her did show that she had pyelectasia and also a very mild amount of perinephric fluid. What did we find with Reggie? So if you remember, Reggie was the one with the hepatic enzyme increase, and the owners didn't have that much money in terms of investigations. So for him, we prioritised an abdominal ultrasound, mainly to look for kind of changes within the hepatobiliary system, ruling out extrahepatic bile duct obstruction. And he just had kind of mild non-specific changes in his liver, looked a bit heterogeneous. We did check a PCV just in case of a prehepatic jaundice, and that was normal. And we got a UA. He was isocyanuric, but he'd already received fluid, so that was a little bit tricky to interpret. So what about specific testing for lepto? So this is a little bit of a tricky topic. So when should we really be considering testing for it? So definitely I would say in cases of AKI, if you've got any dogs that are isocyanuric, if they have glucosuria, any cases of acute hepatopathy or jaundice, if we've got dogs with unexplained acute respiratory distress or suspected pulmonary hemorrhage or changes on x-rays that we've discussed. I'd also possibly consider it in cases that are acutely febrile, potentially acute HGE, but obviously I think you want other clues before testing or considering lepto. If the dog has strong epidemiological risk factors maybe, or if you've got skin and eye changes as well. So why is a definitive diagnosis so difficult in lepto? And I think mainly it's because often the cases are presenting acutely and we don't have our test results immediately available in many cases. And often dogs have also received previous antibiotic therapy, maybe because they kind of had grumbling signs a few days earlier. The organism is very difficult to culture. It's also expensive and dangerous to culture. The other tests that we have a low sensitivity and specificity. So the most useful tests that we have are the MAT, so the microscopic agglutination test, and also we have PCR, but there are problems with those that we'll come on to. We're also increasingly using FISH. So for those of you who don't know what FISH is, it stands for fluorescent in situ hybridization. And it's a fluorescence test that's basically detecting DNA in tissue. It's available at Langford Veterinary Services only at the moment for lepto. So that might be something we consider when we have tissue to test. So looking at the MAT, you only need a little bit of blood for that, and it is our clinical diagnostic test of choice. So if we see a positive titer, it might indicate infection, but also it might indicate just exposure, it might indicate vaccination. But if we see a high titer, it means there are more antibodies, so that potentially might help interpretation. And it's generally considered if you've got a single titer more than 1 in 800 in a dog with consistent signs, it's supportive of a diagnosis. But we can increase our sensitivity by using a paired test, so 1 to 2 weeks apart, repeating your titer. So if you have an initially negative titer, which then raises to over 1 in 800, I would consider that diagnostic, or if you have a more than 4 times rise in your second titer. So the problems with the MAT is that it's quite tricky to control for and to perform, and there are lots of variabilities in the standards between labs. So there is a proficiency scheme for leptospirosis, and use a lab that adheres to those schemes. Also, just because we get a positive reaction on the MAT, it doesn't mean that that serovar is definitely the one causing disease, so you can get crossover there. The MAT isn't suitable to detect our carrier animals or those that are chronically infected. You can see depressed titers in dogs that are on antibiotic treatment, and then there's also the problem of vaccination. So how do you interpret a positive titer in a vaccinated dog? Well, we know that vaccination can cause an antibody response, and it tends to be of a low titer and of short response. But some studies have documented titers being positive up to a year after vaccination, or being as large as 1 in 6,000. So interpretation is always a very much a subjective and kind of case-specific problem. And we do sometimes even see post-vaccinal titers to vaccine to non-vaccinated serovars as well, so that's another challenge. But I would basically say to use your paired titers in situations of vaccinated dogs, and consider an additional testing method such as PCR, which we'll go on to next. So PCR, your sample requirements are on the right, and generally speaking, you only need a very small amount of blood. Urine, as fresh as possible and as much as possible is ideal. And you can also do PCR on your tissue samples as well. So PCR, the good thing about it is it can detect viable and non-viable organisms. So it might be useful if you've got an early stage of antibiotic therapy case, because it can still detect the kind of dying or dead organisms. And when you get a positive urine result, that indicates that that dog is shedding renally. And this might be the case in some healthy dogs, and therefore they're considered carriers. So again, it doesn't necessarily mean they're infected, or it could indicate an infection. So PCR isn't affected by vaccination status. The bad thing about it is that we can't identify infecting serovars unless you kind of do more tests on the PCR. Now, the problems in PCR is that you can get false positives because you're picking up leptospires in the environment, or your lab hasn't got good controls. We also might see false negatives in the blood because the leptospirosis is only transient or the load might be quite low. We might see a false negative in the urine because the renal shedding is intermittent. And again, antibiotic can increase the risk of a false negative. So there is a study that's looking at 33 dogs for which lepto was a differential diagnosis, and they looked at the PCR and MAT results. Now, these only correlated well in 10 dogs where lepto was strongly suspected, and in cases where there was less of a kind of suspicion of lepto, they diverge really quite markedly, which shows the limitations. And so overall, it was concluded that you should interpret PCR quite cautiously, and certainly in conjunction with your MAT results and clinical context. We also have some in-house tests, so the lepto snap test, for example, and this just requires 3 drops of serum. And it only identifies 4 serovars, and it can't tell you the difference again between your vaccinated versus exposure only. In terms of its agreement to the MAT test, we're probably looking at best around about 75%, and it's at its most accurate when you're seeing that peak MAT titer. So IDEX do have a really nice algorithm online that you can look at if you're suspecting a dog with leptospirosis. So I'd urge you to have a look at that at a later date, and they're included in the slides here. So overall, what do I sample when? Well, it depends a bit on obviously your case, but a good rule to go by is getting both blood and urine when they first present, and then blood and maybe urine again 1 to 2 weeks later. So early infection, we're expecting that the dog is leptospiremic, but we might not see an antibody response yet. We don't expect it in the kidneys. So at this point, the best thing to test is whole blood for PCR. A little bit further down the line, we might see seroconversion. So on top of the whole blood for PCR, consider your serum for MAT. And then we've got 7 to 10 days post-infection, which is probably the most likely scenario. Your dog still might be leptospiremic, but we're definitely going to want to do our MAT test. Also consider at this point fresh urine for the PCR. And then later post-infection, we want to consider our second sample for the MAT. And then consider doing your repeat PCR on urine post-treatment to understand if that dog or not is a renal shedder. So looking at our case examples, our results, in Boris, he was urine PCR negative, but he was blood PCR positive. And alongside his titer, we were quite happy with the diagnosis there. So he had a rising titer. Looking at Mabel, she had a positive urine PCR, which was really helpful in her case because she was recently vaccinated. Even though we had a positive titer, we couldn't 100% rely on that. And because of the limitations of the vaccination, we decided not to do a paired titer with her. And then finally, in Reggie, if you remember, he was the one with cost constraints, so we just did an IDEX positive test in him. And because he was unvaccinated, we felt that we could trust this. So next, moving on to treatment. So we'll focus on this for the remainder of the talk. And I think this is the fun part, obviously, because hopefully you can make cute patients like this better. So what antibiotic therapy is appropriate in an acute case of lepto? So I want you to think about, is it intravenous fluoroquinolone? Is it intravenous amoxicillin or penicillin? Oral doxycycline, intravenous amoxiclav and metronidazole, or could it be subcutaneous amoxiclav? And I'll give you a clue, there are 2 correct answers here. So the answer is intravenous amoxicillin or penicillin and also oral doxycycline. So fluoroquinolones are not useful for leptospirosis. They have poor effect. We don't need to use the clavulanate part of the amoxiclav, and certainly metronidazole isn't indicated. And I would always advocate against using subcutaneous amoxiclav pretty much in any situation, because I think it just sits there under the skin and these patients are pretty sick. So as I said, our antibiotic choice is intravenous penicillin or amoxicillin. And realistically, for many people, this might mean amoxiclav because they don't have the former in stock. You might have it, for example, if you're in equine practice. So we want to give it intravenously because the animal's sick and because of a high prevalence of GI signs. And as soon as the animal can tolerate it, we want to use the oral doxycycline. And this is to reduce the risk of renal shedding. So in people, interestingly, reviews have shown that actually there's no difference in outcome between people that are treated with and without antibiotics, but it is still recommended by the World Health Organization to treat with antibiotics. But obviously we've got a lot of other things we need to think about in these cases. So one is fluid therapy, and the fluid requirements in a case of lepto can change really quite dramatically. So they can be as low as 0.5 ml per kilo per hour if the animal's oliguric, going way up to 10 ml per kilo per hour plus if they're polyuric. And this is why I should strongly recommend urinary catheter placement in these cases so that we can really get an idea of the urine output. It's particularly important to avoid fluid overload that these cases are going to be predisposed to. So monitoring for signs of overload, like conjunctival swelling, you might see edema, increased heart rate, rest rate, and you want to be looking at that urine output all the time. So the normal urine output's written there on the slide. We also want to avoid systemic hypertension, as this can have complications. And as I mentioned, we can see a really kind of profound polyuria that can be quite protracted, so multiple weeks, affecting young dogs in particular, which can be quite challenging to manage. So in terms of hypertension that we might see with AKI, a recent study documented that up to 80% of dogs and cats with AKI are hypertensive. And certainly we should be treating hypertension if you've got evidence of target organ damage. So this might manifest in the eye or the brain, or if you're seeing a progressive azotemia. And that's if your blood pressure is over 160 systolic. You should consider treatment even if there's no target organ damage, but your BP is over 180. And there are a few different things that we could use. We can consider the use of amlodipine orally, that you're probably most familiar with. We could also use hydralazine. It's a very potent antihypertensive. We can give that orally or intravenously. Now, traditionally, we would use sodium nitroprusside, a concentrate infusion. But really, that should be a last resort in most cases, as it's quite a toxic drug and it can have a profound effect on renal perfusion. So we're looking at finalidopam as probably being our best bet in these cases. So finalidopam is a dopamine 1 agonist, and as well as potentially reducing systemic blood pressure, it has renoprotective effects in that it can improve your renal perfusion and GFR. So a study has actually looked at finalidopam in cases of AKI, and they found that although it didn't improve outcome in this retrospective study, it did appear to be safe. So it's something potentially we might be getting future studies on and using a bit more in the future. Other things to think about with fluids in these cases is potassium supplementation. Because Hartmann's is relatively potassium deplete, I always put inappetent cases on fluids on maintenance potassium in their drip as well. Later down the line, when we're relying on oral intake, we might want to mix their food with a lot of water to encourage that. And generally speaking, once my AKI patients have stabilized with their azotemia, I start to taper them off the fluids as long as they're able to have some oral intake as well. And regular weighing can really then help you understand, are they keeping up with their balance using your PCV and solids. And then I will recheck our renal parameters kind of 1 to 2 days after stopping fluids and seeing if the animal's coping. So what about hyperkalemia? Well, obviously this is acutely life-threatening if it gets very severe. And we can see ECG changes that hopefully you're all familiar with as well. And the treatments for hyperkalemia are well known. So intravenous calcium, for example, fluid therapy, insulin and dextrose, and sodium bicarbonate is a last resort. Renal replacement is potentially something that can be indicated in lepto patients, so dialysis. And this is to bridge the gap between cases with renal failure and recovery. And it's only available at the Royal Veterinary College in the UK. But they're very happy to receive phone calls or advice if you think you have a case that might be suitable. And obviously, the earlier you get them referred for this, the better if it's deemed useful. Unfortunately, it's only suitable for patients that are over 10 kilos, and that's due to the practicalities of the machine and the things that we have to do to them. We do expect recovery to occur over a number of days in most cases if it's going to be successful, but the costs are obviously can be really high, so £5,000 to £10,000 in these cases. A study of 36 dogs who had lepto within a bigger study reported an 80% recovery in dogs that had a severe azotemia who underwent dialysis that had failed prior medical management, so it shows that it can be a really nice thing to do. So when do we consider this therapy? Well, if your patient isn't responding to medical treatment, as we've discussed, and it is usually reserved for cases with severe azotemia, those particularly that are anuric and oliguric, which is why the focus really should be on looking for that. Also, potentially cases where we know they have a toxin that's dialyzable, if they're volume overloaded and you're struggling to get on top of that, or if they have hyperkalemia and acid-based derangements. What about treatment of hepatopathy? Well, if it's profound and we're seeing hypoglycemia, we obviously need to treat that. Really easy to remember for your glucose bolus in those situations is 0.25 mL per kilo of your 50% glucose solution IV, and then you might want to use your concentrate infusions after if they remain hypoglycemic. We want to treat hepatic encephalopathy with lactulose, your amoxicillin hopefully is already being provided, and then obviously a focus on a particular diet. So if you're providing assisted feeding, this might include using the renal liquid diets or obviously a hepatic diet. We might consider an albumin transfusion if the cases are profoundly hypoalbuminemic. So I might consider it if it's as low as kind of 10, 12, and we're seeing clinical signs because of that. We might want to use antioxidants, so SAMI, silibin. And obviously these are oral treatments, so it might not be tolerable in a lot of cases, and in which case if you have it available you can use N-acetylcysteine intravenously. There is no need to reduce the doxycycline dose in cases of hepatopathy because we understand hepatic injury with doxycycline to be idiosyncratic. What about treatment of the pulmonary hemorrhagic syndrome? Well, we don't know the optimal treatment yet, but certainly it's going to involve oxygenation if the patient's hypoxic, and some cases might require mechanical ventilation. Other treatments are being investigated at the moment, so it's potential that we'll know more in the future. Treatment of hemostatic disorders can be quite challenging. Certainly, we might want to use packed red blood cells, but only if the dog is only needing red cells, so if they're anemic and cardiovascular compromised. Fresh whole blood will obviously provide clotting factors, and also transiently, so for less than 24 hours, we'll give you a few platelets as well. And generally speaking, plasma transfusion only reserved for cases where they have an increase in their coags and they're kind of clinically bleeding, really. And it's no longer recommended to use heparin if you've got a case of DIC unless the case is clinically hypercoagulable. And that's also the case with antiplatelet drugs. Other supportive treatment might include gastroprotectants, so omeprazole, which we now know we should be using twice daily. You might want to use antiemetics. I find ondansetron to be a really useful anti-nausea drug, so you can get that IV and orally. And then finally, understanding, do we need to provide assisted nutrition in these cases as well? So monitoring of the cases depends a little bit on how critical they are. But as an example, I'd definitely be looking to do heart rate, rest rate, blood pressure, urine output and hydration status as a minimum kind of every 4 to 6 hours. Oxygenation, your blood, your body weight and temperature every kind of 8 to 12 hours. Electrolytes might need very close monitoring initially, especially if you've got hyperkalemia. But once they're normalised, you might want to do electrolytes and blood gas alongside your PCV solids and creatinine daily. I also do blood smears daily if the case is thrombocytopenic to understand if we're getting resolution of that. And then depending on the changes that you had and the patient's progression, considering full hematology and biochemistry every 1 to 3 days. I would probably only check coags post plasma transfusion if that was required, or if you see a change in the patient or planning to do something invasive. What about our nursing considerations? Well, I think the main one that I've recognised in these cases can be that venous access becomes a challenge. You're doing repeated blood samples, you're needing prolonged intravenous fluid therapy. So you should consider central lines in these cases, but obviously it's contraindicated if they're thrombocytopenic. We're going to want our nurses to really regularly assess the patient's hydration status, so get them to do that alongside the TPR. And then, of course, there is a zoonosis risk with lepto. So in people, it might manifest as an influenza-like illness. So these are dogs that we barrier nurse, in particular, to avoid contact with the urine. So what treatment did we give our cases? Well, we had Boris. He required a few boluses of Hartmann's until he became more cardiovascular stable. He didn't have a urinary catheter placed because he was thrombocytopenic. We then worked out his ongoing fluid requirements at 5 mL/kg/h. And this is based on the box here where we calculated his deficits and his ongoing requirements. And then obviously we closely monitored his urine output by just kind of collecting his urine as and when. We supplemented potassium because he was hypokalemic. He received intravenous penicillin for 3 days, but he had quite profound GI signs, including melena. So it wasn't possible to give him oral doxycycline for the first couple of days before that was started. Mabel, she also needed intravenous fluid resuscitation. And she received IV penicillin. And then because she was a puppy, we needed to really get her eating well as soon as we could. So we started meropenem and mirtazapine, and then we were able to start oral doxycycline. Particularly with her, we had a close monitoring of her blood gas and her hyperkalemia and also her glucose when she was an appetent. We did end up placing a central line 3 days after she was admitted due to repeated blood sampling, and we had difficulty maintaining a peripheral IV in such a wriggly puppy. Finally, Reggie. So he was very stable. After we'd done our investigations in him, we started oral doxycycline. We did consider Sammy, but it's expensive, and as there's no evidence for use for its benefit, the owner declined. So congratulations, your patient has survived a discharge. So what do we tell the owners? Well, common sense hygiene at home, so using gloves and disinfectant if the animal has any accidents in the house, getting the dogs to urinate away from people and animals or where they might come into contact with that. The consensus panel for lepto recommends that any dogs living in the same household as a dog with lepto should receive a 14-day course of doxycycline as well. We obviously want to see the dog back for a repeat titers or PCR if we need to do that for diagnosis. And then it's recommended to reassess your renal parameters regularly. So we'll go on to why this is. And then consider repeating your biochem, hematology, your analysis as and when if you've got any kind of abnormalities that you want to track. So the prognosis for lepto is fairly good if it's treated aggressively, so 80% survival potentially. and the prognosis is worse if there are pulmonary complications. So it's really interesting that about half of dogs surviving the acute phase of lepto will show impaired renal function for up to a year afterwards, and that's why it's really important to keep a close eye on the urea, creatinine, USG, proteinuria, things like that in these cases over that time period. So what happened to our cases? Well, Boris was a bit challenging because it took him quite a long time for his thrombocytopenia to resolve and because of his GI issues, but he did make a full recovery and his renal values were stable 2 weeks post-discharge. For Mabel, her hyperkalemia and her renal injury luckily didn't progress any further, but she did have extreme polyuria as she was recovering, and at her peak she required kind of 15 mil per kilo per hour of fluid, so she was a real pee machine at one point. She also required prolonged potassium supplementation because she was losing this in her urine, but we managed to discharge her once she was maintaining fluid balance orally, and for that reason we did use kind of sloppy food a lot with her. We were able to give her her second vaccination when she was clinically doing very well 2 weeks later. She did have ongoing azotemia and polyuria at this time, but we documented that to resolve fully by 4 months later. And then finally, Reggie, he was discharged very soon after hospitalisation because he was more stable, and we rechecked his biochemistry 2 weeks later, which was shown to be improving. And generally speaking, with liver enzymes, I would leave a bit of time between rechecking because there's always a bit of a lag time. If you remember, his USG was reduced, but he was on fluids, so we followed that up, and his USG was normal. So he seemingly got away with any renal complications as well. Quick note on vaccination, I appreciate we're just coming to an hour now. So remember, lepto is a core vaccine, and it's recommended to use the quadrivalent vaccine. There is no evidence to vaccinate more frequently than annually, however, but you might want to consider in your high-risk dogs to vaccinate them at the high-risk period, so kind of springtime. If you diagnose a lepto case in a non-vaccinated dog, it's fine to vaccinate as soon as they're recovered. And I know there's been a lot of fuss about potential adverse reactions to the lepto vaccines, but studies have shown that these are no more common than with other vaccines, apart from maybe increased owner-reported adverse events, which I think we should probably take with a bit of a pinch of salt. So here are some really useful resources. Lastly, the BSAVA have a really nice complete fact sheet on lepto. There are two consensus statements. The American one's a little bit old now, but the European one was 2015. And then finally, if you want to know a bit more about the finalpam in AKI that I mentioned, the study is quoted here. But if anyone's got any questions on the back of the presentation, please get in touch and I'll do my best to answer them. Thank you very much for listening, everyone.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Sarah for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.